Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi.
We're mass communicating.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for them.
This is the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I gave it a 10.
Sweep the leg. You have a problem with that.
And now, here are your hosts, Rocky LaFleur.
Everybody on? Good.
Great. Grand. Wonderful.
No yelling on the bus.
Josh Webb.
Sorry I had a fight familiar, your butt at the party.
And Jake Latondras.
I am bad news.
Also starring Rob Kroon.
I bet this guy's into the woods $100.
And Bradley Ramsey.
No, Mark, been saying.
Showtime.
All right, here we go. Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
Showtime, everybody! Showtime!
Welcome to the End of the Line podcast. I'm Rocky LaFleur, sitting in the Duck South Studios on this Wednesday morning. And we step off into another chapter of The Path. And The Path is a story episodic series with one of my favorite people, Mr. Bill Cooksey. Bill, how are you this morning?
I'm doing well this morning. I'm ready for it to cool off, but it's a pretty day here, and ready to get this going and get some work done and move on towards duck season.
Talking about weather, did you see the 10-day forecast? Have you seen it?
I haven't looked.
Holy moly.
Is there anything good in it?
Yeah. I mean, the next 2 or 3 days are supposed to be pretty rough, but after that, man, hitting about, where was it? Next Wednesday? Woo! Nice little cool off.
Nice.
I'm actually ready for it. Fall is here. Low 80s, high 70s.
Nice. Those are the kind of days you can get caught up on the yard work the heat's kept you from doing and get it done ahead of the time of year we all want to be away from home.
Some of us wish we could enjoy that right now, because look, I know we spent the past couple of days in the opening talking about these mosquitoes, but good grief, man, they've been bad.
They have. People think I live in the middle of Memphis, but I deer hunt in my backyard, and it backs up against low ground that's wet a lot of the time, and God, our mosquitoes are awful. Just awful. I spray, you know, the hose in permethrin around our back porch every week. And it's supposed to work for 6 weeks. It works for 6 days.
And I just feel sorry for them. If you are touching that Mississippi Delta or within 5 or 10 miles of it, you know, to the Mississippi River Delta in Arkansas, Mississippi, or Louisiana. Woo! But,
yeah.
You know, with fall, you know, I was telling you before we came on the air, and I said a little bit about it yesterday, man, that the fall, I always get a cold this time of the year. It's the only time really I ever get sick with the weather. Uh-huh. It's in the fall. I'll get a bad, stay stopped up for a couple of weeks.
You probably just have an allergy to something in the fall.
Take you a Claritin
and you'll get over it.
Hey, Bill, before we jump in your story, I want to ask you something. Did you ever get on Duck South last night? Were you on there at all?
Yeah.
And
did I miss something?
I don't want you to jump heavy off into it, because this is something that you and I could sit here and talk about forever. There was a video that was posted 4 to 5 different times after it got deleted. 4 times. Posted 5 times.
I saw Jeff Estes said something about it. I never saw the video, but I did see that post about, hey, don't post this anymore.
So the thing about it that I want people to understand before we jump into the story is we all did stuff like that when we were kids. We did dumb stuff like that. I did stuff like that. But
what took place?
It was a kid. He had a head from a Canada goose. He put his, wrapped his t-shirt around the windpipe of the goose, and then act like he was blowing into the windpipe and somebody to the side was blowing a goose call. It looked like he was blowing through the goose's mouth. That is something in the social media or the tech-savvy world that we live in today that you would just text to a buddy through a group message somewhere on text. That's not something that you would share in an open public forum for all the world to see. I never said, because look, Bill, I'll be the first one to admit, I did dumb stuff like that when I was a teenager hunting. Yes, I was raised the right way to hunt and fish, to be, you know, taught respect for what we're hunting, but to put it out there for the left and the right to see, you know, it's more about me than it is about respect for the sport of hunting. It's to show me off.
Sometimes people get ahead of their own judgment, and some people don't have much judgment, obviously. I mean, in the early days of the Duck Commander, when, you know, Phil would bite a duck on the head, hey, that's a great way of dispatching a cripple. It really is. But you don't put it on television. Same as when he ate that peanut out of a duck's craw. Do you remember that scene?
I do.
Pushed peanuts up out of a mallard's craw and then ate them. He ended up in the hospital over that one. But
wow, you never heard that end of the story.
No. You know, and I get why Shock Value sold him a lot of videos, but to me, those are like hunting's kind of like making love. You and your partner know what's going on. So things that are okay or funny in the process are great. But when you film them and you put those out in front of the world, it's a different feeling. It's no longer the positive experience. You know,
wow, what a great way to explain that. That is, man, that is an awesome way to explain that.
I guess inside jokes is a good way of looking at it. When you're there and in the moment, it's not a problem. Everybody laughs. Everyone's on the same page. You put it on tape and see it a week later, a day later, or a year later, it's ugly. And it doesn't do us any good.
No. Overall, for the man, there are people that are on the fence and to the far left that would jump all over that. And see, that's what this hunters are all about. You know, I look at how far we've changed socially in this country in just the past 25 years since I was in high school. Things that used to be taboo now are just so wide open. But I see the next train after all of this other stuff has changed through our culture. Hunting is going to be one of those final things that come after. And that is the type of video that they would utilize to come after. Like that.
In the end, it'll be a numbers game. As long as we can keep most people okay with it, we have a fighting chance. But anything we do to any ammunition we provide to those who want to take us out, they will use. I'm not an all or nothing. I know people who say, the heck with them. They want to take it away anyway. So why should we worry about what they think? I understand what you're saying. And in some cases, like, you know, I've even argued that we're legislating with our large predators, especially in the West with bears, wolves, and mountain lions. We're trying to manage wildlife from the court bench, and that's wrong. And it's because of people who don't get it, don't understand, and their votes. That's coming for all of hunting. It's coming. We need those people who don't really care one way or the other. They're okay with hunting, and we have to always have them in mind and how we look to them. It doesn't mean you can't wear camo when you go to the store. I see people argue those, you know, you don't even want people to know what's taking place. Well, if we have to hide it that much, it's not worth having. I know people in Europe who are like that. They would never go out in public looking like they've been hunting. And I've had them come here and hunt with me. Guys from Great Britain years ago came and we duck hunted and then went straight somewhere to get breakfast from the blind. And they said, aren't we going to change clothes? I said, why? Because if people can see we've been hunting, it's going to be a problem. No, it's not. And we were in McCrory, Arkansas, so it was a non-issue, but they were shocked by that. That's coming here. And the only thing that's really going to stop it, we can do a lot to hold it back, but in the long run, short of a big shift in this country, which sooner or later will happen, it always has everywhere through the history of the world, a big shift back to a more fundamental conservative type mindset, it's just going to happen. But it could be 100 years from now, 200 years from now, 300 years from now.
Hey, Bill, let me ask you this. You, of course, in your days of running Avery, you'd have been running the social media pages of Avery if it was still blowing and going. But I want to ask you this. Mm-hmm. What would you have done if that would have popped up on, say, the Avery Facebook group? You saw that video pop up. Because here's the reason why I asked you that. And I'm not trying to justify myself by asking you that question, because I know what you would have done. But so many people said, oh, man, this is just y'all are a bunch of snowflakes taking this down. No, I'm not a snowflake. I just think that there's a better way to represent hunting to the public.
And look, I don't mind, you know, guys are guys, and they're not doing this professionally. They're just having fun hunting, and sometimes things are a little not exactly production quality or the thought that goes into a production video. I get it. But if whatever platform it came up on or website, whatever, yeah, I would have immediately deleted at least the video. I'd have, depending on the platform, if I could, I'd delete the video and leave the guy up there so I could actually speak to it and say, don't post this again. Anyone on here who posts it will be banned. You know, if you post again, you'll be banned. Anyone else who posts it will be banned. And I don't like banning people. That's the last thing. Yeah, you know, if you go back to the way I treated the internet forums, only one time in all the years did I even ask a forum to delete a post or to lock. I actually asked them to lock the post, not delete it. I had forum owners calling me saying, hey, do you want us to delete this? Because it's bad. I said, no, man, let it go a little longer and I'm going to answer. You know, so I'm okay with controversy and all that. But that deal, no, you can't have it. You can't do it. You want to put it on your own page, that's fine. But it shows you have a lack of judgment.
That's right. That's exactly right. Sorry to tie up the beginning of this episode with you, Bill, talking about that. But, hey, it's time to jump back into the story. Now, last week, we had said that we were going to open this episode talking about the jobs that you had right out of college, but there was a couple of things that you wanted to add to last week's, or you wanted to add a part into last week's episode now.
Well, yeah, I have to answer because a friend of mine actually listened to the podcast and said, dang, man, I didn't know you only hunted and fished as a kid. I figured maybe you had some chores and that sort of thing. So I need to answer that. Like everyone should have had, I had plenty of chores. I mowed our yard, my grandparents' yard, and anyone in the neighborhood's yard who would, this was before we moved to the farm. Starting at 8, I was mowing yards. Kept mowing yards and on the farm, worked on the farm. And that was a great experience. I mean, back then, our high school football team actually hauled hay as part of raising money to build a new field house. So did a lot of the work that I imagine a lot of the listeners of the podcast and the members of Duck South did when they were growing up. And then in high school, I had the most fun job I've ever had in my life. And folks from West Tennessee, especially Jackson, will know Brooksy's Barn. I worked in the barbecue pit in Brooksy's in high school. And that was more fun than I've ever had on a job. And part of that was on Friday nights, I would get calls from people like Harvard Alexander in Jackson, and who had a great duck hunting spot, asking if I wanted to hunt the next day. And if I did, could I bring some of the ribs and some of the pineapple fritters? And so those evenings, I would clear out the buffet of leftover food. We had to throw it away or use it. So I could clear it out and take it hunting the next day. So my job in high school actually got me a lot of hunting opportunities. Plus, I had fun doing it. Now, it was a year before the smell of barbecue was out of my clothes, but it was a ball while it lasted.
I can imagine the reek of barbecue, man.
Whew. But did you know pork rib bones float? At least the cooked ones do.
No, I didn't.
I've seen a duck blind surrounded by 75 or 80 floating rib bones. So it's.
But we did say last week that after high school that you went to California State. Is that correct?
Cal State Northridge.
Cal State Northridge.
After school, I actually went into the aviation industry out there. Worked at Van Nuys Airport on avionics. I did installation and service and a little bit of sales. Early on, it was more service than anything, and I learned along the way. And I loved Southern California. I enjoyed my time there, but I never planned to stay. It was just one of those deals where I'm having fun, but eventually I'm moving back to the South. That day came after being out on a date where there's a big group of us, all of us with our girlfriends, and I'd always out there, I was used to people who hadn't met me, especially ladies saying, you know, where are you from? As soon as they heard my voice. And when I realized the people at the table who didn't know me, none of them asked. They didn't hear my accent. I said, it is time to go. Yeah.
It's kind of crazy that you end up in avionics right out of college, because you actually went for writing, correct?
Yeah.
You're going to be an outdoor writer.
And now, during college, I decided I really don't want to do that. And after that, I was kind of lost. And the whole avionics thing came about through my father's business with Peterson Publishing, a man who ran this avionics business in Van Nuys, who was a big hunter and knew these Peterson people and eventually worked on Peterson's planes, that sort of thing. Matter of fact, it was there that I learned a man really needs to get a passport and keep it up to date, because I missed a free trip to Argentina on the Peterson Gulfstream, where they took their own guns, their own ammo. Everything was paid for. You just had to get on the plane. And I was actually working on the plane, you know, 22 years old, working on the plane, and they were leaving the next day and had a cancellation. And Pete had someone call over and ask if my dad was going on the trip, but they asked, hey, could you get away and go? And of course, my boss said, hell yeah, you know, because he's a hunter, he recognized that opportunity. And then they said, you need a passport, and there was no way to get one in time. Yeah, I have some ducks in my office, some, you know, mounted birds, actually a goose and a duck from that trip, but I wasn't there. So I've had a passport ever since and kept it up. That's a lesson to young guys. You just never know when that opportunity will come. But yeah, when I decided it was time to leave, I took 2 weeks off, drove to Tennessee with a buddy, and we did a lot of fishing and had a lot of fun. It was during the summer. And I interviewed in Johnson City, Memphis, and Nashville at the time. And the company in Johnson City, it's a big helicopter outfit. Had a lot of patented products for helicopters, and I went to work there in August. I actually moved to Johnson City the week of the Bristol race. I'm not a NASCAR fan, so I had no idea. And that was a bad week to start out in Johnson City. But I lasted until February, and during that duck season, I was like, I can't do this, because it was horrible. I found myself driving back to West Tennessee every weekend, and that was starting to you know, take a toll. So, as I did before, I took what little vacation I had, went down to Chattanooga, interviewed, got a job there. That hunting there was good enough. I stayed for 2 years. Right at the end of 2 years, a friend called, and he had just gotten a promotion with an insurance company and asked if I'd be interested in selling. So I did that, and that was in Memphis. So that got me back to West Tennessee and got me in a happy place. And it also, that's one of those businesses that gives you a little bit of time to have fun outdoors. You know, if you want to hunt for a few hours in the morning, you can, or in the evening. It's not quite as, typically quite as structured as a normal office, you know, or clocking in type of job. So it was great for a while. And then I realized to really make money, at least with the way that company was structured, to really make money, you had to sell people more than they needed. And it got to where I just couldn't do it.
Man, there's a ton of competition in it. I mean, it's all, I actually sold insurance out of college at one time, and why did I wasn't successful? I kind of felt the same way you did. Two ways. One being, look, it was some people I was selling to that barely could put groceries on the table. But they did. They needed life insurance because they had kids. Needed something to fall back on. But, you know, there were, and on top of that, like I said, there were so many people out there trying to sell the same thing as you. It almost was like auto, selling cars.
Right.
Everybody's got a Buick LeSabre. There's four people in town selling it.
Correct. Correct. I mean, it seems like there may have been some change there, and I don't know, but you don't see agents out calling on people like you used to, or you don't hear about it. Hopefully now it's a little bit cleaner process, and the folks, you know, a lot of us kind of, I hate to use the word prayed because that's wrong. We were offering a service they needed, but, you know, you went towards the lower income folks, and you were selling them pretty crappy insurance because that's all they could qualify for.
Right.
So, that eventually got old. But the cool thing, because it did put me out of an office most of the time, I found a little hunting and fishing store in South Haven, and I'd hang out there when I was down in that area. I'd go in there for an hour or two, you know, and that was at a time when people would still just hang around in a sporting goods store.
Right.
Then along that time, I also met Roy Rhodes, who, you know, was a big in the game call business back in the early 90s. Roy had won the World Duck, the National Turkey, and the guy was incredible with both instruments and a good guy. Met Roy, and then through Roy, I met his brother, who was about to start a wholesale electric company business, selling to electrical contractors. When he started that, he called me and said, why don't you come over here? You can make more money. You can feel good about it. Set your own hours. Do your own thing. So I did that and did that for a couple of years, and I enjoyed that work. I really did. You know, with contractors, it was funny. You'd get out there at 6 in the morning and meet with all of them, you know, call them, meet with them, that sort of thing, and by 10 or 11, your day was mostly done. And I also got to take a bunch of them hunting. So that was my first real on-my-own deal where I was taking people I was trying to sell to on hunting trips, which became very important later on, you know, at Avery. But then after a couple of years, Wayne Rhodes invested some money in Roy's company and decided he wanted someone over there he could trust. So I went to work for Roy. And that was my first job in the outdoor industry, was sales manager for Roy Rhodes Championship Calls. And my first sales call was to Cabela's.
Did you ever just sit back at that point and say, ah, man, this is where my life was intended to be in this world?
At that point, I was scared to death because it was kind of a non-traditional way to make a living. You know, I looked around, and as I moved on, I met more people in the industry and realized, okay, you can make a living and not necessarily be the guy with the name on the door. But, you know, all I knew was Knight and Harold and David ran it, and did anybody else really make a living? How far will this go? So it was scary, but it was exciting at the same time. And obviously, it's fun when you were able to get out in the field. But I made some boneheaded deals. I mean, back then we were trying to get ammo, guns and ammo for hunting season, to take riders and that sort of thing hunting. And one of the first things I did, I called Ken Levin at Bismuth and a guy at Remington, and I forget who it was then. And it all changed within a couple of years after that. And both of them said, well, fax me what you want on a letterhead and we'll look it over. Well, I faxed the Bismuth one to Remington. And the guy called me laughing, and I thought, oh, God. He gave me double what I asked for because he thought it was hilarious. And, you know, here I was genuine and apologized and all. And that was a good lesson. Don't be scared to screw up. Just do it. You can usually work it out later. That was one. And, you know, at our first podcast, we actually talked about, I started to say my biggest misses in the outdoor industry. And you said, hold that for later. And I have one right now because it happened in the couple of years I worked for Roy. I was at a little show at Home Sporting Goods in Paris, Tennessee. We had a booth up there. And I'm standing there, and this was 1996, I think. And Gary Mason, who runs now runs Legends of the Outdoors Hall of Fame, at the time he was an outdoor writer. He did some promotions for people. He did a lot of guiding, and he guided in South Dakota every year for pheasant. And he had just come back from South Dakota, and where he had spent most of the season with this guy named Tom Dockin. At the time, Tom Dockin wasn't a name people outside of the serious dog world knew. I knew who he was because he trained retrievers, and I was into field trials and hunt tests. Tom had just designed that deadfowl trainer not that long before, and Gary was showing it to me, talking about how awesome it was. And it was like $23, $24 then. And I thought it was the most ridiculous hunk of plastic I've ever seen in my life. And I was wrong in a big way. Yeah, and he's a great guy. I've gotten to know Tom fairly well, and just a super guy, and he's always innovating. And look, 10 years later, I'm sitting in an office at Avery with a group of people, and we're trying to figure out how to make an item do the same thing that doesn't infringe on his patent. And we did. So I went from saying it's a joke to, we got to make something like this. So, you know, there was the Roy Rhodes deal, and that, I was still working for Roy when I married my wife, Nina. But shortly after that, I actually went into the magazine business. And for the Hunting and Fishing News, I sold advertising. I wrote two monthly columns, and I handled all of their circulation. And that was a good learning experience. I learned more about the ins and outs of magazines.
For who now? I didn't catch that.
The Mid-South Hunting and Fishing News.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And, you know, and I went back to work for them, like, 15 years later. But that was the last thing before I went to Avery. I was there for about a year and a half, and then Avery hired me. Every one of those steps, from even in avionics, I moved because of ducks and changed because of ducks. And it's kind of interesting they led me along this path.
And before we really jump off into Avery big time, because that's going to take a few episodes, but Avery at the time when you took that job, what was their reputation on the street? Up and coming, well, new kid? I mean, you knew in the back of your mind, hey, this thing's about to explode.
Well, to some extent, it already had. You know, Avery started in 94. I went to work for them in 99. They started with the Quickset boat blind, and it quickly grew from there. So, you know, so Avery was, they were the big thing in waterfowl. But to say that, you have to understand there was nothing and waterfowl. I mean, yes, we had a few decoy companies. We had a few companies that made some accessories, decoy line, decoy bags. We had a few game call companies. But if you opened Cabela's, it was two pages. And that was your decoys, your calls, your lanyards, your bags. I mean, there was no blind bag. There was no floating gun case. You know, if there was, it was some little company no one knew about making it locally or something. You didn't find them nationally. Avery had already made that, started opening that category up. And a lot of things came together besides, you know, the innovation at Avery. You know, 94 was the year when suddenly duck season changed. That was the year when states got to decide, are you going to go with, what was it, 40 days or four ducks? Some states went with four ducks and some went with the 40 days. And that started the numbers of hunters coming back up and the amount of stuff people would buy back up. And so the timing couldn't have been better.
And it kind of goes back to what Will said in his podcast, you know, timing is everything in business.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of hitting primos, starting primos today, right now. He couldn't make it. He would make it, but it wouldn't be what primos is, you know, now, no. 20 years from now.
No.
It's all about timing. And Avery hit it, had a door to run through, to kick down and run through, and they did. I don't want to get too far in the story, but there was a need, and Avery filled that need at the time, like you're saying.
Right. I mean, it was, you know, I think Hunter Specialties at that time was our biggest competition, and HS in the early 80s, I can remember them having a big push on duck hunting stuff. Now, you remember they even had the decal set where you could use a 2-liter bottle and make decoys? Put decals on and had this keel that fit on it. They made duck calls. They had all kinds of stuff, and they scaled back. And I think they got caught kind of behind, so they had to play catch up to Avery. But when I went to work at Avery, it was a mess. Now, they had been doing well. The growth had been good. Everything was made in the United States, and a lot of it was made right on Cumberland Avenue in Memphis, Tennessee. The problem, there were a couple of problems, though. One, the year prior, Avery had had a warehouse fire in August, which was right when back then the big shipping occurred. I mean, they had all production staged to start going on trucks. And 2 days later, there's a fire and everything's virtually destroyed. I mean, there was some stuff, you know, they brought ozone machines out and all, and they were able to recover some things. But that hurt them bad, obviously. And about the time they started recovering from that, factories started closing down. And this is what a lot of people don't understand. The outdoor industry is tiny as an industry. You think a lot of people are, you know, a lot of folks think people are getting rich. They aren't. Very few people have come out of the waterfowl industry with more money than they went into it with. Mostly people have made a living. Because of that, if you want to make a blind bag and gun case, you have to find a factory that makes hammer bags, purses, similar items, but for a different industry. And then you give them your, okay, I need 800 of these and 1,000 of these. And those were the kind of numbers we were talking about back then, especially when you got into, okay, we want these in Mossy Oak Breakup, this in Advantage, and, you know, and we want 300, 500, 1,000. And they would make those runs with any kind of fleece pullovers, you know, outerwear. You had to find a factory that made clothing, and they would do it because afford to staff. I mean, you can't have all these different products being made under one roof. They require different machinery, different people. There's no way you could afford to do it. Blinds are generally made by tent companies. Well, all of those companies started producing overseas. Clothing companies moved to China. Tent companies in China. All of them left. And some of them did it in the middle of our production year. So we would have raw materials we had paid for in various stages of manufacture in the middle of the season. We've paid for it, but the factory is shut down and the bankruptcy courts have the doors chained. So to make anything that year, we had to go to court for almost every piece of goods and then somehow find people to sort it out and fix it and make it. And that's how, you know, Avery was staying in business by the skin of their teeth because of influences that were beyond their control. And they got through it. It was, looking back, it's amazing how everyone this there pulled together and got it through.
This all occurred in that first year that you were there?
Well, the fire happened right before. But
right before.
When I got there, they had not made products in China. And by the next year, most of our stuff was overseas.
Before we go, give the people that's listening to this just a little bit of background and history of how Avery all came about.
Gotcha.
And who were the owners?
You know, the three guys who started Avery, first would be Tom Matthews. Tom started it, and Tom was the ramrod right up until a big upheaval just a few years ago, and we won't go into that. But Tom, it was his vision and his deal. Then Tate Wood came on board with him, and I'll explain that dynamic in a second. And then I forget how many months later, and I knew these guys at the time. I didn't know Alan at first, but I met him later. I think it was 6 months or a year later that Alan, he had invested some early on and was doing some work with them, but Alan was an investment banker. But after a bit, he said, you know, I've got to give this a try, and he went to work with them. But the whole deal came about. Tom was he's from Memphis, or from Somerville, Tennessee, but he was a real estate guy, commercial real estate guy in Houston, Texas, which is a great field. He was with the right company. He was doing great. Just got married. Life was grand, except he hated what he did. He hated every minute of every day. And he was back home, I think during the holidays, and went duck hunting with a guy who had been his big waterfowl mentor named Avery Wood. Avery was Tate Wood's father. Avery, for years, had been making these pop-up boat blinds. And that's not an uncommon thing in that part of the Mississippi Delta. There were several guys who had their style of boat blinds. Unlike a lot of the Arkansas timber and public areas, you know, Mississippi, the water's more up and down, so that a lot of times you couldn't stand next to a tree, so they had boat blinds. Avery and Tom were sitting there, and Tom was lamenting his career choice, and Avery said, you know, if a guy could figure out how to take this blind here and get it in a box where UPS could ship it, I think he could get rich. So Tom went home and did that in his garage.
Wow.
And that was the start, you know. And then Tom, yeah, so he brought that out and got Tate Wood involved. Tate was, you know, they were all pretty much just out of college for the most part. I mean, they had just really gotten their lives going. So it was a good time to change that direction.
And they had a relationship. They all went to Ole Miss, correct?
Alan and Tom went to Ole Miss. Didn't Tate go to state?
Tate went
to state. Played ball at state. Yeah. Yeah, and I honestly, I don't recall how Tate and Tom originally met. They may have both gone to MUS in Memphis, which is a big, you know, super private school here. I think all three of them did. But that may be how they met, and Tom somehow, he and Avery just hit it off, you know, Tate's dad. So they met along that time. And it all fell together later. But, you know, so many things. You know, he got Tate in there, and
Tate had I'll say this about Tate.
It was Tommy Aiken who told Tom, you need more than a boat blind.
Well, I'll say this about Tate. Man, Tate had one of the most innovative minds around. I mean, because Mr. Avery, he developed that blind. I mean, it was his own kind of development, but, you know, Tate had that innovative mind, kind of like his dad, on built products. I don't know that much about Tom, but I just know that about Tate, man. He's always thinking, or he used to be just always thinking how he could improve something, how he could make something better.
And that was, honestly, that was kind of the mentality of a whole bunch of folks at Avery. Tom, definitely. In the end, a lot of times that was when people griped about products not getting there on time, which is a huge problem. A lot of times it's because we didn't feel it was right yet. You know, or someone said, this isn't right. We got to fix it before we actually take it to market. And sometimes that was after we'd already put it in catalogs. But, you know, always striving to make changes. And sadly, the market demands that, even when it doesn't make a product better. There are things about some Avery products today that I don't like as well as the products in 1999. Certain products, not all, obviously. But the market demanded the changes.
Well, so, with no competition, really, at the time, was there anything really to compare what you were making there at the beginning to?
No.
And that's
no,
why the rise, I call the rise of the king. And that's what we're going to call that next chapter next week, because the rise happens, man. The king comes, you know, like we used to be kids. We used to play king in the mountain. You found a hill where somebody piled a pile of gravel, and the biggest
sure.
boy got up there on top, and he threw the little ones down as they try to came, you know, come up there after him to take his spot. And that's
right.
what happened in those 90s, man. Avery became the king of the mountain. Everybody wanted to be a part of what was going on at Avery. And there's a huge story coming over the next couple of weeks, Bill, of how you played that part of who you chose and who you let in to be a part of that. And, you know,
we'll go more into
to those early years of Avery and, you know, like we talked a little bit about today, the fire and taking stuff overseas. We'll get more into that and that part of the story also in the next, you know, next week and the next couple of weeks.
Well, you know, right at that same time, you have to look at what happened with Max Prairie Wings. You know, Max started putting their catalog out, and then they built their new store. You know, they went from, if you ever went to the old Max, I think now there's some kind of little off-brand church in there. It was last time I paid attention. But it was just a tiny little store. But Max exploded. And they exploded with Avery. It was all time together, whether meant to be or not. There was constant communication because Max could see what the consumers were looking for long before we could, because they were talking to them every day because they sold direct to them. So there was great feedback, and it worked. It just worked really well. The people would gripe about, you know, I can recall, and I'll throw a few things out there, just a few quick anecdotes. When Avery started making real grass, there were people upset because we knocked off fast grass, which fast grass didn't make it, and we didn't either. We all got it at the time. I think it was out of Haiti. I may be mistaken, but I know at one point it was out of Haiti. We did that because Max called and said, we can't get enough from them, and we need more. That's why we started making it. When Cabela's and Bass Pro saw Max and started really grasping what their numbers were, you know, both had started making their catalog a little bit beefier, you know, up to 5 and then 10 pages of waterfowl stuff. And then suddenly, here come their waterfowl catalogs. Right, that crap didn't exist. If, you know, we had, what, in the 80s and early 90s, we had Dunn's, Herder's, you know, there were some catalogs, but it wasn't the same thing. It just wasn't.
Not at all.
You know, now everyone has a waterfowl catalog, and it is packed with stuff, and most of it good stuff. You know, Avery and Max together changed the industry and really opened it up for a whole lot of companies to come in, a whole lot of people to make a living where none had ever really been made before or where only a few had made a living before.
Bill, they say that life is all about the journey, or the story is all about the journey, but man, I'm going to tell you something. I look forward to the next couple of weeks as we talk about that time there at Avery, more. We talk about your role and what you played in that, because like you're talking about, Avery changed the world of duck hunting as it is today. And I was that high school, college kid at the time that just looked at it in amazement, you know, at the same time. And you were talking about Max and Avery, and you know, flowing along at the same time right there was Mossy Oak Whistling Wings. And all of it played a huge part in bringing people. Wouldn't understand if you had to go back to duck hunting in the early 90s, late 80s. They would not believe what duck hunting was then. They only see the boat races and the fights of today, when, you know, if you could have set a microphone in the woods years ago, it was complete silence. There were some duck hunting, but you know, it wasn't the wildness and craziness of today by any
means. But you know, in the heavily hunted, the Biomita, my first trip to Biomita, friend and I drove over Thanksgiving night. Spent the night in the old Max parking lot. They opened at 4 o'clock in the morning. We walked in, bought our license, drove to Biomita. We had never been there, put a boat in, and there were hunters everywhere, just like today.
No. On the public properties, there were. What I'm saying is, you know, I can remember nobody intentionally flooding, you know, fields. Nobody. Anyway, I never went to Arkansas.
It was rare in Tennessee. I mean, growing up, Tennessee always had some places that had been duck holes for as long as anyone can remember, and they would flood them on purpose. Some they had to wait for God to do it, you know, and they'd just block up pipes. Others had relifts, that sort of thing. But it was nothing like today. Arkansas, of course, just because of the rice ground as much as anything, it's just always been easy for them to have water. And so that's really why I started hunting Arkansas more than anything. It was easier to find a place.
West Tennessee and
Western Mississippi have tons of ducks if you have a good spot, but there's so many more spots in Arkansas.
It just kind of all flowed together. The commercialization or the money making off of duck hunting all kind of bottlenecked right there in the mid to late 90s. And it all happened in that time period. That's what I'm trying to get across.
Absolutely. People who didn't hunt before then would, like you said earlier, would be shocked with what it was like. I mean, if you either had a bucket or an ammo can that you kept your stuff in, the clothing we wore was different. The guns we shot, you know, I think it wasn't it the early 90s when Browning stopped manufacturing the Auto 5, about 1990, the real Auto 5. And they said it was because it would cost over $1,000 at retail to continue making it. And they didn't believe anyone would ever spend over $1,000 for a semi-automatic. Now guys spend $1,500 for a fake Browning Auto 5.
I just think about my, you know, I think about waders that guys used to wear in the late 80s, early 90s, before duck hunting specific waders were made in the sense of, you know, because the waders that were made back then were multi. You could use them in multi types of situations. And
you hoped your local store would have some Hodgman Wadewells in your size.
The first pair of waders I ever had.
Buying uninsulated brown waders
first two pair of waders that I ever had, though, Bill, the first pair I had, those things were just rubber, just a rubber covering over your body. I called them the Mean Greens. And they were cold. If it was cold, you were cold. And then I had the ones where Walmart started carrying a waiter that they put in the the hunting aisles, but you slipped on boots or shoes over those back in there. That was about
the mid-90s. Really lightweight ones.
Yeah,
that were about $10 or $12.
Yeah.
I had a pair. I knew I was in trouble when I opened the packaging and several of the staples were actually put through the waders. but I gave them a try.
I just hope that we can feel, I hope that we can, or you can mostly, help people realize, man, like you talked about today, the need that was filled by Avery coming into the waterfowling world, because at the same time, kind of like you explained today, waterfowling was really changing and going in another direction in a positive way. Because water, you know, with the point system of the 80s and early 90s, waterfowling was it was on life support.
Oh, yeah. You had to love it to do it. We had a 30-day season. We had a 3-duck limit. Now I was single then, so I hunted more days in a 30-day season than a lot of times I get to in a 60-day now. But in reality, it was tough. I mean, our season would end, like January 12th, closing day of duck season. It opened up in Arkansas Thanksgiving Day. Tennessee, it opened early December. It was hard to justify spending a lot of money. Why would you? You just don't get enough time. Leases were cheap. I mean, my first Arkansas lease was $1,000 for the pit and the house. Yeah. And it was a decent place. You know, nowadays it would probably be a $6,000 or $8,000 deal for that house and that pit.
Well, Bill, I look forward to, I know you've got an appointment you've got to get to. I really look forward to next week because we're going to spend the next couple of weeks talking about that time at Avery. It should be a lot of fun. I think you're going to blow some people away by some names that you bring up that became some of your pro staff members, some of the famous people in the duck hunting world today. That's where they got their start, cut their teeth. I really look forward to that. Bill, thank you again for being here. And we want to thank all of you that listened to this edition of the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
Ladies and gentlemen.